When you're sitting around the Thanksgiving Day table, does this mean it? Do you actually mean this when you say this? Mom, can I help you with anything? No, of course. You don't really mean that, do you?
No.
Ladies and gentlemen, are you ready for the Dawn of America Live?
I couldn't find this guy, so fast forward, a year goes by. We're close to wrapping up season three. Finally, I get a hold of Bruce Rocks. I find him after, you know, a Boba Fett-esque hunt.
I debated whether or not I was going to release the books under my own name because you obviously attract a lot of kooks in this field.
Yeah.
So Rocksgiving just kind of all came together, and it was like, now we've got a Thanksgiving special.
And it is a very nefarious plot, and it is extremely well dramatized, and it is entirely credible. The idea behind all of this program in the first place was to present ideas to the public in a way that was laughable enough that you could dismiss it, but serious enough that you could actually think about it. You could do both at the same time. And for the most part, it worked. We're talking about it now.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, Banal of America Audio, with your host, Tim Banal.
No commercials, no subscriptions, no network, no rules, and at the end of the day, my friends, no comparison. And on this installment of the program, no leftovers, because it is Rucksgiving 2013. It's our way of giving back to you guys, saying thanks to Bruce Rucks for becoming such a big part of this program, and sort of just a big celebration all the way around. And I'm really excited about it, as usual. Our guest is, of course, the incomparable Bruce Rucks. He starred in the Rucks trilogy way back in season 5, I believe, and then he went on to star in this holiday tradition that is known as Rucksgiving. There's really not much else to say. I talked to him a few days ago. We're both really looking forward to this. We've got a slew of questions from the BOA audio listeners, tons of them, and they cover all kinds of stuff. So we're going to be getting into a whole variety of different topics. Welcome back to the show, Bruce. Thanks for taking part in another Rucksgiving.
Always a pleasure, Tim.
Did you ever think, like I said before we started the show, I made a little joke there when we started the music. Did you ever think when you put your name on the books that you'd not only be tracked down, but then end up having your own holiday special?
Nope, definitely not.
It's pretty cool. It's been an amazing ride. So I'm really looking forward to tonight. What have you been up to since the last time we heard from you? I forgot to mention in my boisterous intro there that you were also the first guest ever alongside Nick Redfern on the live show. So this is your second go-round here on BOA Live. But what have you been up to since around August when we last talked to you?
Not a whole lot. Just kind of general research and doing a lot of reading for entertainment and kind of relaxing for the most part. I'm kind of stuck on death watch for my mom and have been for a couple of years. She's not in any imminent health crisis, but she's going on 96 years old now, and she's been in a home for a couple of years. So I just kind of keep the home fires burning and keep the house in order.
Nice, nice. All right. I hope everything goes okay. It made me sad now. Start off.
Oh, she's fine, actually. I mentioned that I do these things. Mom doesn't even know how to operate a computer. She's very old. But I tell her that I'm doing these things. She says, oh, that's nice. Are you talking with friends? I say, yes, I'm talking with friends, Mom. Says, oh, that's good.
Exactly. Yeah. So we are amongst friends here. This is the show to really give back and give thanks, to the listeners and give them a chance to participate in all this. And like we've said before, when we do the show, it's kind of like you and I are just sitting around having a beer somewhere. And so we brought them all in with us to join in on the fun as part of Rucksgiving.
And now, I might actually have a beer before it's over. You never know. I'm drinking coffee right now.
Nice, nice. We'll see if I can. Well, maybe I'll dig one up here myself. We'll see.
There you go.
One thing I actually wanted to mention, this is completely off the reservation on this whole thing, is that I'm not a big fan. I don't know how you feel. I'm not a fan of this late Thanksgiving this year. This November 28th is a bit too late in the month for me for Thanksgiving.
It's
going to be
weird.
Christmas before we know it.
Yeah, it's very weird. I'm used to having it in the third week, obviously, and when it comes all the way at the end, it's kind of like, what? That's when you get those really late Easters or really early Easters. I don't mind the early Easters, though.
Mm, yeah. Yeah, it's really weird. I looked it up, actually, because I was like, this doesn't make any sense. Did they change something with Thanksgiving? That's what I was wondering at first. I thought it was always the third Thursday, but apparently there's some other condition at work, because this is the latest it can be. For folks who want to impress their friends or family on Thanksgiving, here we're going to drop some knowledge on you. The 28th is the latest Thanksgiving can be, and then the earliest it can be is the 22nd. I'm not sure the rules of how it all works, so you might want to look that up before you brag to your family. But next year, I think it circles back around. No, it starts working backwards now. So it'll be the 27th next year until it gets back to the 22nd, and then it loops to the 28th.
I wouldn't be surprised if they figure it on the lunar calendar some way. They do that with Easter. Easter is always done on the first Sunday after the first full moon after the solstice. It's always that. It's been that way all the way back to ancient Egypt.
Yeah, I don't know. I'll look it up while we talk here, but I'm not sure what the rules are on that. But I think I'll find that. I don't want people to be like, what's he doing here? So let's get into the questions. I was a little nervous at first because we barely got any questions. Then they started coming in fast and furious towards the end. So I realized that I guess I did give people enough time. So this one came in a long time ago. I think we talked about this off the air, you and I, but it comes from Lawrence Manzo. We'll use his full name because if they contact me on Facebook, I'll just use their name. He says, according to my calendar, Ruxgiving is nearly upon us. Well, Lawrence, it has arrived tonight. So here is your question. He wants to know about the Bionic Man versus Bigfoot. He says it's never come up in the interviews, yeah. And he says it came out in 77, had an incredible resonance with real events. First, Bigfoot is pals with the ETs, and also the ETs are meddling with our nuclear program, and they have underground bases and abduct people, too. So he wonders if I'm too young to remember it, which I was. But he bets that you have a lot to say about it. And then he talks about how they used to be on YouTube, but now they can find it on Hulu. So please look into this and be sure to ask old Rux what he thinks. So what is all that about, Bruce? Because this is way before my time.
Well, I do and don't have a whole lot to say about it. I remember that very well. I didn't catch up with the $6 Million Man mostly until later sci-fi reruns. It wasn't one of my favorite shows. I did tune into it every now and then in the 70s. Mostly in the 70s and the 80s, I was on stage practically every night of my life. I was acting all the time. So I didn't get to see that much TV. And a lot of it I had to get in reruns down the line. The whole Bigfoot thing, I remember, but I don't remember all the details. The mere fact, the stuff that you're bringing up is calling it back to mind.
Yeah.
The fact that there are abductions and that they're doing sabotage and all that other kind of thing. I remember that Bigfoot was hiding in a cave, and Steve Austin ended up fighting Bigfoot. He ends up becoming good friends with Bigfoot, which has become a running joke on the Venture Brothers, if you ever see that show on Adult Swim. It's the funniest thing they've got on. So he was a running character. They actually had more than one Bigfoot episode. I think in one of those, Bigfoot got programmed to fight Steve Austin because he's kind of semi-robotic, as I recall. He had implants, or he might even have had some bionic limbs himself. At this point, I really don't remember. It's been decades.
Was the Bigfoot Andre the Giant or no? I don't remember that.
He easily could have been.
Okay.
He was under so much makeup, I really couldn't tell you. That was a pretty good Sasquatch costume as far as that goes. I do remember that the ETs kept him in a cave and that Steve Austin met the ETs that way. And he basically found out about Bigfoot and kept Bigfoot secret because he didn't want government interference with him or anything like that.
Yeah.
So he was, in a sense, kind of in collusion with the aliens and with Bigfoot. I do remember that much. And I remember that it was a sort of a running thing. I don't remember how many episodes they had with Bigfoot, but they had at least a couple of them, as I recall. I think they did have like a two-parter, and I think there was one other one. But I don't remember the details on them. All the stuff that you're bringing up, I only remember that because you're bringing it up.
Yeah. Well, it was 1977, I mean.
Right.
I'm surprised they haven't tried to remake that yet, but give it time, I guess, right?
Give it time. They did try to redo The Bionic Woman. As a matter of fact, I was enjoying that. But it wasn't... friendly with my schedule, with my work schedule, so I only got to see it every now and then, and by the time I got around to watching it, they'd already canceled it.
Yeah. Yeah, it says here, looking up a little bit, it says the Bigfoot was a robot created by the aliens.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Yeah.
I thought he was either bionic himself or had mechanical parts or something like that.
Yeah.
I know that he was in league with the aliens, we'll put it that way.
It says he was constructed by the alien Shalon, in imitation of a lower life form from their alien homeworld. So, using a technology called Niosynthetics. So we're really getting deep into the
cool
the canon of $6 million Man. And for the folks who I don't want to leave them hanging if they have OCD like me, it says here the Thanksgiving rules are the fourth Thursday in November. I always thought it was the third, but apparently it's the fourth, and that's why it's only...
That makes sense. We only had four this month, right, and it usually falls in the third week.
I see, yeah, because there are usually otherwise five somehow. Okay, that makes sense. See that? This is why it's the Thanksgiving special. We get to the bottom of these things.
There you go.
Now, since $6 Million Man is way out of my range, so hopefully Lawrence was happy with that. I think also, let's just revisit it a little bit. Do you think there was any sort of agenda behind that, or just sort of they just threw all these interesting paranormal fiefdoms of the Bigfoot, the aliens, the Bionic Man, just kind of threw them all together and had them interact? You know, do you think there was any sort of like message behind all that, or just that, hey, you know, it's all connected somehow?
Six of one, half a dozen of another. That was a Glenn Larson show, as I recall. I don't think Larson was actually consciously in the project at all, and I don't think a lot of the producers or directors were. They just got the story ideas thrown at them. Someone in the production chain was in on the joke and seeding stuff out there. Most of them were just, you know, contractors doing their jobs for the day, and it was just one more weird sci-fi story for them. They didn't care.
Yeah.
So there could have been a conscious agenda behind that. Not really sure. I do think there was in similar shows like Wonder Woman. They had several episodes with ETs, and not infrequently they fit within the exactly what I write about. They had a running character who was kind of Klaatu from Day the Earth Stood Still, who was a good friend of Diana Prince, and literally did lay the smackdown on the UN, basically, kind of visit Earth and said, look, you guys got to get your act together or we got to wipe you out. And he was a running character. I think they had three different episodes with him.
Weird. Interesting. Okay. Like I said, this is outside of my realm completely, so I don't have much to add to the $6 Million Man conversation. So we're going to move to the next question. How's that sound?
Sure.
All right. I see. I have to do the digital version of cutting the turkey here, folks. So I have to, you know, make sure the cranberry sauce gets passed around.
There you go.
I've only got a handful more Thanksgiving puns and metaphors to use. Don't worry, I'm almost through them all, right?
we'll come up with more.
There you go. Joey Herbs asks, any more MIB encounters?
Happily, no. That all pretty much stopped right with 9/11. They had bigger fish to fry, and not that I'm happy about 9/11, but I'm at least happy about the result that I'm very low on their totem pole anymore. They don't really need to keep close observation on me. They didn't need to before. I don't know why they did. But I'm not a high priority at all. I'm a kind of guy that they can easily keep track of, you know. I keep a very low profile in the first place. And when I do appear publicly, someplace like here, they can have somebody listening. It's not a big deal. And for that matter, if they really wanted to listen in on my conversations when I'm out for coffee or what have you, they've always been able to do that. So they may still be around in some form or another, but I haven't noticed them since 9/11.
That's good. Well, that makes sense in a way, because from what we talked about, it sounds like they weren't aliens or anything. They were just dudes at the behest of the government. So
no, they're goons.
Yeah, I can imagine that.
It's just
some,
the goon squad.
Yeah, then 9/11 happened, and they were like, "What the hell are you doing? Get back from Colorado, you idiot! You know, we got a serious issue on our hands." Leave
yeah,
the ruck
we've actually
style.
Got bullets flying around. We can't be peddling with bullshit like this.
yeah. What do you think raised their ire so much that you were doing good research on the alien, you know?
I know what raised their ire so much. They told me. I understand them. We've had frank conversations. Let's just put it that way. Their main concern, I think, is that they don't want anyone doing this kind of research to be trying to create a religion like Scientology or panicking anybody. I think that's their number one concern.
Interesting.
And since neither of those things was in my purview at all, I had no intention of trying to create any kind of religion, and I certainly didn't want to panic anybody. If anything, I was trying to dispel any fears that people might have. The joke on that is that if anyone puts out scare stories, it's the government itself. But the government's left hand doesn't know what its right is doing, and they've got people working across purposes. So, if anything, I think I actually am kind of helpful to them. Their first book, my first book, they weren't happy about, but There were a lot of people in the intelligence community that wanted to be talking about the same stuff themselves. They just can't because of their security oaths. So I've actually got some fans in government circles. I don't know who they are. I mean, I can't name them. I couldn't look them up or give them a phone call, but I know that they're there. And occasionally they do make themselves known. The second book was an entirely different can of worms. They were really, really ticked off about that one. But that's because it was getting into MKUltra and the Kennedy assassination and all the stuff that they really get bent out of shape about.
The second book's amazing. I've only leafed through the first book. I need to give a dedicated... someday we'll do another Rux trilogy to that book. But the second book, I remember the introduction to the second book. I had jury duty. This is how well I remember the book, actually. Like, I remember where I was when I was reading it. And I was engrossed in, you know how they make you wait in jury duty for, like, a long time till they decide to let you in if they're going to use you or not? That's the situation I was in. And I had Hollywood versus the Aliens with me, and I read a good chunk of the intro there. And the introduction's huge. It's like its own little book in and of itself. It's amazing.
Yeah, a friend of mine criticized me for that, actually.
Well, tell him he's wrong. He's wrong. The intro is amazing. It sets the groundwork for everything that comes in the book and is incredibly detailed to the point where I remember when we were doing the interview, I was like, I need to just spend a long time on the intro because there's so many interesting points in there. I feel like that's probably a summation almost of what's in Architects of the Underworld, right?
Largely, yeah. I had a lot of new material in that, going back to the World War II stuff especially, with the Nazis and the Allies and their various intelligence circles and what they were picking up. So there was quite a bit of new material in it, but it was largely a summary of the first book also.
Now, do these, when you have these frank conversations, they don't want you to start a religion or scare people. Is that kind of what they just spell it out pretty much for you, and you're like, listen, I'm not. They don't believe you, or they just kind of still someone keep an eye on you? Or
I got this from the guy that threatened me.
Ah, okay.
After threatening me and after exchanging quips, and we sort of settled down a little bit, he just spelled everything out for me. He said, look, you know, this is where everyone's coming from. There are a lot of people that aren't going to be happy about what you're writing about. And at which point I just kind of laughed and said, what, I'm not going to get my invitation to the Bush family Christmas dinner this year? And I was so looking forward to that. I was expecting it, but I can't believe you're not going to have me. So, yeah, I knew there were some people that were going to be pissed off about it. But, yeah, they just spelled everything out pretty much that bluntly. We ended up talking for, I'd say, a good half hour after he threatened me. And then we had what I would call a decent conversation or a substantial conversation. They should lead off with that, you know?
Yeah.
What the hell is with you people? You can't have a conversation with someone until you threaten them? What? You know, just, here, buy me a fucking piece of pie. Let's have a cup of coffee and relax, okay?
That's... I think it's good. It's in keeping with the holiday. Give the man some pie. That's all. We'll settle down. Yeah, well, it is kind of weird. You wonder what they're thinking there. It's like insecurity on their part. I presume no, but also maybe they're...
Actually, I think they just wanted to rattle me.
Yeah. They want you to kind of go home and just put it all down, and maybe then they don't have to, you know, do any work, any paperwork or anything. So, like,
yeah,
all right, we scared him. It's fine.
Well, plainly, they never followed through with it. There was a guy, one of the later spy guys who came by, it was before 9/11, say probably a year before then. He started coming by another coffee shop that I hung out at, and I spotted him instantly. There was nothing outward about the guy that would say, this guy's a spy. But the second he came walking in the door, I knew. And I even looked to one of the waiters there. They knew some of this stuff. And I said, you see that guy there? I said, yeah, watch. He's going to be at my table in a half hour. Watch. And he was. He was at my table in a half hour. He came in, he sat down, he immediately asked the different waiters and waitresses about me. He was sitting across the restaurant from me, doesn't know me from Adam. He just comes down and sits down and starts asking questions about me immediately. And within 30 minutes, he's over at my table asking me about my books. I mean, I laughed at the guy.
That's just weird.
Yes, it is just weird.
He didn't know you were in the place? Or was he trying to, like, tweak you out by having you...
Well, in theory... In theory, but, you know, what makes sense in this? The guy came from Colorado Springs in the first place, which is, you know, a 90-minute drive. So, yeah, you just happen to drive 90 minutes to the one coffee shop in the entire state in Aurora that has the best coffee in the world. And it's the first time you've ever been here, but someone told you that. So you came down here, and out of the blue, you saw some guy sitting there and decided you'd ask him about who that guy is sitting there, as opposed to any other guy sitting around the restaurant. And within 30 minutes, you're sitting at my table asking me about my books. No, you're not a spy. Of course not. Silly me. How could I possibly come to such an erroneous conclusion?
He's just very curious about you.
Well, I brought up, when we had a regular running conversation, he would come in periodically and we'd just chat. And at one point he asked me what my problem was with the government guys. And I said, look, you guys sat down and threatened me once, you know, and I spelled it out. I gave him the exact threats. He sat down and flipping threatened me. And this guy looked at me like, so what? He just said, well, they never followed through on it, did they? And I thought, yeah, you're right. They only threatened to throw acid in the old lady's face. They didn't actually do it, so that means they're good people, right?
It's weird. Well, that's how nonchalant, I guess, they are about it. The guy's like, yeah, that's our policy, man. What's your problem? You never been threatened before?
Yeah, that's just it. Like, what is it with you guys? Do they do nothing but read G.I. Joe comics?
Maybe they're all, like, have desk jobs and shit, so they're... You know, when they get a call, they're fighting over who gets to go harass you, because otherwise they, you know, they have to look into someone who's, you know, making counterfeit money or something boring like that.
Well, this guy, interestingly, he was Air Force. He didn't have an Air Force uniform on. He was a nerd. He was just wearing glasses and dressed pretty much like a basic nerd. I just knew he was a spy. I could tell it was something about the way he was standing or something. I just knew. This guy was an optometrist for the Air Force, actually.
What?
Yeah.
Weird. It's... At the same time he was bothering you, or before you got into all that?
Oh, that was his regular day job.
Yeah.
I don't know who contacted him and said, hey, you know, you might want to go check this guy out. Just, you know, whatever information you might be able to bring back, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
I don't know what these guys do. I don't understand these guys at all. They're just weird.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, maybe, yeah. I don't even know. I wouldn't even begin to speculate any further than that. I have no idea. We're just really into the realm of... me constructing alternative worlds for the optometrist guy, so.
Right. Let's just go get these guys.
Yeah. Okay, Hillbilly, who's also in the chat right now, he sent in the question. He wants to know what you think, do you think the mainstream science/archaeology community is hiding/ignoring anomalous proof that we have had previous civilizations that rival or surpass what we currently possess?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty obvious yes from you. I guess I read the question and I was thinking to myself when I read it, let's change positions a little bit. Let's say we're on the other side. We're the mainstream science/archaeology community. Aside from, I guess, covering our own financial input and making sure we still have jobs and stuff like that, and we don't want to upset the apple cart and lose tenure and everything, what's the motivation for mainstream science and archaeology to even keep all that a secret? Wouldn't it be better for us if we knew that we had a previous civilization that burned itself out? It would teach us a lesson to be more judicious with our weapons development and everything else. I mean, it would be better for the human race if we knew that they had a previous civilization like that. So what's the motivation for them to keep it a secret, do you think?
Do you remember Planet of the Apes?
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Zaius.
Absolutely.
He blows up all the evidence that they find of the previous human civilization that was more advanced than the apes. And as soon as he finds it, and as soon as Taylor's gone, he blows it up. And the younger guy looks at him and says, Dr. Zaius, what about the future? And Zaius says, I just saved it for you.
All right, yeah. See, so now put that into the context of what we're talking about, though. So you think that they... I'm confused, though, because even in that story, it's the human race blew themselves up. So wouldn't he want the apes to know that the possibility exists that we could rise to the level that we destroy ourselves, so we better be careful?
When they got later into the film series, which when I first saw them, I didn't find as compelling as I do now, they fit very, very much to exactly what I'm talking about. You get into the later films, and it turns out that the apes themselves were manufactured by human beings in the first place.
Hmm.
They owed their existence. They were a slave race for the advanced humans in antiquity.
Almost a Sitchin-esque story.
Yes. They're going exactly with the Middle Eastern tablet stories of the human race having been created as slaves for the gods in order to take care of their needs. They eventually had a rebellion. They overthrew humankind, and mankind wiped itself out. Now, mankind... They got into this even in the second movie. They got a little bit squirrely with it, a little bit too sci-fi, but the idea was still sound. There are some of the apes that have figured out that there are still human beings alive living underground in the caves.
Yeah.
And they're scared to death of them. They mount a military expedition to go and try and take them out. The reason that they're so scared of them is because they are more advanced. And in the time that they've been gone, they've actually developed their psi powers, so they're now more psychic. That got a little bit squirrely, but they've also got an atomic bomb down there, which is what Taylor ends up blowing up at the end of the second movie. They're just terrified of the four runners. And even in later movies after that, they still had stories where one of the apes would figure out, say, look, there are human beings down there, and they find the advanced civilization. They haven't found the human beings yet, but they're afraid to find them.
Yeah.
They know they're there. And I very much think that that's what's been going on with the government for a long period of time. It doesn't matter who they were. The mere fact that they are there frightens them.
Hmm. That makes sense. They don't want, yeah. They're afraid to even acknowledge. It's like a boogeyman.
Yes, it's the boogeyman.
Because they could still be around. They don't know.
Yeah.
That's spooky.
That's why I think everyone's so scared of Mars. They're still there.
So they don't want, yeah. They do kind of treat the planet with kid gloves in a way. You'd think that they'd be able to, I don't know, I've gotten into this with other guests before, and I think I may have even with you. It's very frustrating that the United States has dropped the ball so badly on space exploration. We should already be kind of coming and going from there and have developed something by now.
Wouldn't that be nice? Wow, would I love that.
Yeah.
I dearly, dearly hope with everything in me that Star Trek is our future. I do not believe that we will ever reach that point, but I dearly hope that we do.
Well, are you still on board with the moon hoax, though? Because it, you know.
Yes.
All right.
I've actually done a lot of research into
that. Oh, yeah. We talked about that, I think, last year, and people got all excited, and that movie came out that you were talking about at the time, Room
237. I just saw that.
Okay.
They finally released it, and I just saw it. The movie itself was kind of a disappointment. There are much, much better movies on YouTube that run for like an hour and 20, hour 25 minutes. If I could think of one off the top of my head, I would recommend it. But there are several there. I remember watching one through that went into much more detail than Room 237 did. And the funny thing about that is once you know the joke, you spot things that everyone else has missed. My favorite one, Widener, the guy who really first opened the door on this, Jay Widener, had caught that all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy, also means A11 work and no play makes Jack a dull boy. One thing that hadn't been noticed was how many letters are in that sentence. There are 33, or three times A11. And the reason that becomes interesting is that there's a coded question at the very end in the photograph, which has to do with the numbers. That's far too complex for me to get into. I don't remember it all. But it came down to a question of whether Kubrick was saying that he had been involved in two or three different Apollo 11 frauds. My answer is three because of the 33 letters in All Work and No Play.
Huh. So three fake moon landings, you mean?
Yeah.
Interesting.
He filmed three of them.
Wow.
That's my guess.
Yeah.
He put all kinds of different codes into that movie, and they very much fit in with the Apollo 11 business. The reason that movie stinks as bad as it does is because he wasn't making a movie of Stephen King's The Shining. He was filming his own confession.
Hmm. You mean, so you don't like The Shining, the movie, is what you're saying?
It's terrible.
Oh, I think it's a good movie. I'm surprised you don't like it. It has its issues, but...
Well, it's got about the ugliest production design I've ever seen in a movie, first off. The colors are hideous. The pace is terrible.
The pace is what I was thinking of. It's like watching paint dry.
Yeah, exactly. It's just a dreadful movie. When we left that movie, we were all really excited when it first came out. I remember this very well. We had a party the night before. We did a bad movie night the night before The Shining, and about 20 or 30 of us got together. We were watching just all kinds of movies. We did a sleepover, and we were going to get up way early in the morning and get in line. We ended up, I think, like 30th in line or something like that. And a friend of mine had actually gone ahead into Wyoming, where they were doing showing the night before. He drove all the way out to Wyoming just to see this. This is how excited we were about Kubrick doing this.
Wow.
He came back, gave me a phone call, met with me privately, and said, we can't tell everyone this. This movie is terrible. And he was describing it to me, and it just sounded awful. And I agreed that we couldn't, you know, be the killjoy, so we just kind of pretended that we didn't know. And sure enough, we went in the next day. Everyone left that theater, I don't mean just us, I mean everybody, was leaving, hiding their faces. They were just kind of, you know, and everyone standing behind them getting ready for the next show. How was it? It was really cool. And it's going, oh, yeah. It was awful. Nobody liked that movie. It was getting rave reviews all the hell over the place, but nobody liked it.
Yeah.
And anyone who did liked it because they said it was the funniest movie they'd ever seen. They thought it was a comedy.
Odd. See, it's hard for me to put myself in the place of you guys being so excited for the movie, man. I understand that, but it's like a whole different era, so it's odd, you know. I can't imagine.
Oh, yeah.
You see these classic movies, that they've changed, the opinions have changed so much over the years.
Oh, yeah. Well, and there are people that like the movie, and I'm not dissing them. People like what they like, you know, for whatever reason. It just, aesthetically, I thought it was a dreadful movie. It just had the worst aesthetics I've seen in a movie in many, many years.
I see what you mean. I see what you mean. Well, that makes sense, because I haven't gone back and really watched it since the first time I saw it. It's not the kind of movie I see on TV where I'm like, I got to watch more of this. This is great.
I have gone back and watched that movie so many times now that I want to kill myself. But I've been doing it because I've been looking for the codes.
Well, that, yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. What's the best, if we were going to direct people to find out more about this, more Wiedner, send them to check out Wiedner's stuff, or is it someone else who's doing additional work there on that?
Wiedner or Wiedner, whichever it is
yeah,
the guy who opened the doors on all of this. And he goes into great detail. I wish he would write a book. He goes into great detail not only on The Shining, but on all of Kubrick's other movies. In fact, he really zeroes in, obviously, on 2001 and the cinema trickery that was taking place on that. And he shows how it was used in the Moon hoax. He shows you the demarcation line for his particular rear screen projection.
Yeah, I think I've seen the part of his movie. They have a fantastic intro song. It's like this weird under the Masonic moon song. People, you know what I'm talking about? I don't know if you remember that song or not. It's crazy.
No, but it sounds cool.
Yeah, it's awesome. It's awesome. I've listened to it like a million times. It's really short, but it's creepy. It's creepy as all get out. I'll send you a link to it. I'm sure you've heard it.
Oh, yeah. I probably have. I'm just blanking.
Yeah.
But anyway, he shows the demarcation line on the screen and how he uses it to create the vista in 2001. And then he shows you the moon shots. And sure enough, in all the moon shots, you can see the demarcation line. There's always going to be that demarcation line. They do what they can to disguise it, but you can still see it. So, yeah, he actually provides a lot of physical photographic evidence to go along with all of his theories. I really wish he would write a book on all of this. He's written a series of articles, and I think he would just do everyone a favor if he wrote a big book on it.
Yeah, I don't know. The movie, I guess you have to go with the movie, right? Well, he hasn't put out the books yet, so I'm
right.
Not sure what he's waiting for on that. But I've been meaning to get him on the show to talk about it, because you and I keep talking about this theory, so I need to talk to him.
Oh, yeah, that's one I would definitely want to listen to. Wiedner's a guy I'd like to talk to.
Well, it's pretty remarkable stuff. Now, is he the focus of the room? Obviously, the room 223 is a bunch of different theories. But
it's a bunch of different theories. They barely touch Wiedner's stuff.
Okay, but he's the guy they use, right? In the, you know.
Well, they do interview him.
Okay.
He's actually late in the movie. They do interview him, and he probably gets about 5 minutes. He does bring up, I would say, the primary points, but just the tip of the iceberg. He doesn't get to get in any real detail at all. The other stuff that's in that movie, I found it kind of disappointing overall. It is still kind of interesting just for the other theories and what they're talking about. There was a lot of speculation on Holocaust imagery in that movie. And
like a Native American thing, too, right?
Native American especially, right. That was kind of hard to miss. I know it was the Calumet brand with the Indian headdress and all of that thing that was constantly popping up, and the different Indian artwork in the hotel and all of that. And they even bring it up in the script. So, yeah, I'm sure that there are other layers to that movie. I just hate Kubrick for throwing layers in that don't make sense. But Kubrick was the kind of guy that just liked jacking off in front of people. He liked proving to everyone that he was smarter than they were. And he often did that at his audience's expense.
Now, how confident are you because I feel like the message of Room 223, I haven't seen it, but part of how I interpret it just from reading the reviews and stuff is that there's all these different things you can see in the movie, but the people are putting them in there themselves through interpretation. I mean, how far are you into that idea? Is it possible that all this stuff is just stuff that people have superimposed onto the movie based on what they're looking for, or you actually
some
think
of it,
the
yes.
stuff really works?
Some of it, yes. The Apollo stuff works. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of detail on that. That's what I mean. Like, there are much better movies on YouTube that go into great detail on this with the photographic evidence and do a tremendous job. I watched one for an hour and 20 minutes one night that hit pretty much every point. And the only thing that I'd caught that it had missed was the 33 letters in All Work and No Play Makes Jack a Dull Boy.
Yeah.
I think there was one other thing that we'd caught that they'd missed. Now I can't remember what it was. Everything else, we'd caught some stuff once we understood Widener's basic theory. A friend of mine who's really, really into Kubrick had no problem buying this when I first brought it up to him. And he did a hell of a lot of homework on it, and so did I. And we found things that Widener had, at that point, missed. Now, he's probably caught them by now.
Yeah.
And I know other people have, because I've seen stuff on YouTube. They've also caught a hell of a lot of stuff that I've missed. They've caught more stuff that I missed than I've caught that they missed. Now, the point is, like I say, once you know the joke, it leaps out at you. You kind of can't miss it.
Well, here's an interesting twist on all this. I feel like we covered Hillbilly's question pretty good. Hillbilly, you're in the chat, so speak up if you're not happy with the coverage of your question. But I want to stay on this moon hoax idea, because we just had the JFK assassination anniversary.
God help us.
Yes, on Friday.
They're still insisting Lee Harvey Oswald killed Kennedy.
It's amazing. The coverage was amazing. Just how, I don't even know. How misled people are, or just how overbearing the misleading is in a way, but it's clear we're probably almost never going to figure out or get told what happened with JFK unless it's like another 50 years from now. You know, by the time you and I are long gone,
it was spelled out decades ago. Oliver Stone basically hit all of the major points. He got it just about nailed down. If you've done a lot of research into this, and God knows I have shelves of books on this subject. It's a whole vocabulary. If you want to get into the Kennedy assassination, you have to memorize all the names, dates, places. You have to be ready to present a court case. You have to go at it like a lawyer. It's exactly like researching UFOs. You've got to memorize all the stuff, and there's a lot of stuff to memorize. But once you have it down, and once you chase it down, it's really not that hard to figure out. It was a mafia CIA job, and everyone wanted him dead, so everyone made it as easy as possible.
And they probably all agreed not to rock the boat because there wasn't really anyone championing him, probably except for his brother, who then was also subsequently killed.
There you go.
So it does make, you know, it all adds up in a way. I guess the to circle back to the question, it's like maybe we may never even find this out. To tie it into the moon hoax part of it all, do you think we're ever going to find out that if it was a moon hoax, we're going on that start? Do you think it'll ever be revealed, or they'll somehow just figure out a way to get to the moon and pretend like they just got we're going to take another swing at this moon thing, you know, that kind of thing?
Well, I'll tell you what's funny. They practically admit it every time they open their mouths and talk about going to the moon again. When Bush first brought up saying we can get to the moon in 20 years, I'm just laughing. They say, wait a second, didn't we go to the moon back in 1969? What did we do, lose the technology? And it only took us like 10 years to do it then. But you're saying it would take us 20 years to do it now. What are you actually saying here? And then Obama just killed the whole program. He came in and said, we can't do this, and killed the whole program.
Here's one of my problems with the moon hoax theory is that wouldn't some of these private space ventures – are we going to reach a point where the private space ventures are going to have to blow the whistle on the moon hoax in a sense where they're like, listen, we can't get out of the Kuiper belts, so the jig is up. We can't, you know, or is there just so much money involved and everything else that they'll keep their mouth shut for a little while longer too?
Six of one, half a dozen of another. It's kind of the Capricorn one thing. It's like, look, we need to keep our funding going. We really can't do this, and it's important that other people believe we can do this. So just buy into it, you know, play the lie.
Makes sense.
So, yeah, I think some of them will probably do that. There might be some possible whistleblowers, what have you. If you follow my theory or Widener's theory, Kubrick actually was blowing the whistle on it, saying, you know what?
Yeah. But we need a better revelation than a hidden message in a, you know, 40-year-old movie.
Yeah, he just would have gotten the ball rolling.
Yeah.
He would have done his part to expose that down the line. I do think it'll come out somewhere down the line, but God knows when or how.
Yeah. It's, like I said, it's kind of a catch-22. If it really was a moon hoax and they can't get to the moon, then it'll have to come out eventually. But I could also see, you know, we're pretty old now. I was young when I started this, but I'm not anymore. And I've known you for about 6 years, so you've grown older. And they don't even have, like, the technology to do too much with the private space just yet. Anyway, it costs a lot of money just to do the most minimal things. I think the thing is, like, oh, we'll take you up off the planet and circle around the planet a few times for $250,000. They could probably they could stretch that out for, like, another 15 or 20 years, and by then I'll be, you know, I'll be 50, almost 60 or something. So God only knows. At that point, I won't even care anymore, and they just could just keep it like that for a long time till another generation comes along.
Well, I'll tell you what floors me. We could be making regular round trips to the moon using shuttles. I remember I kind of came up with a proposal for how that could be done. It was theoretical. But sure enough, there was a NASA astronaut, I can't remember his name now, who wrote a novel using the exact same theory that I was talking about with a couple of extra additions to it. And I said, good, I know that the other guys are thinking the same thing that I'm thinking. This could be done, provided certain elements were in place. The biggest problem, actually, would be getting past the Van Allen belt. If you can get past the Van Allen belt, and it's possible we can.
Yeah, I called it the Kuiper belt. I'm an idiot.
Yeah, it's all right. I don't think anyone really keeps track of these things. They're not using it in a daily vocabulary, so of course you're going to lose track of it. In any event, if you could deal with the radiation of that, and if you could deal with the radiation of the moon itself, provided we have nuclear propulsion, and NASA has admitted that we have nuclear propulsion, even though you'll still find textbooks saying that we don't. But
yeah.
It's been openly admitted. They said they were using it at the end of the Apollo missions. Okay, fine. So if we have nuclear propulsion, and if there is water on the moon, and we know that there is water on the moon, okay, well, if we have those two things, then in theory, there is no reason that with refueling stations, and if you could set up a permanent base of operations on the moon, that you couldn't just make regular round trips to the moon, like making a round trip to Cairo.
Yeah.
We could have been doing that since 1972. I don't know that we have been. In fact, we probably haven't. But we could. I mean, if we really wanted to, that's the route that I would go.
Mm. I'm getting a little fuzz on you, so if you're outside...
Yeah, I'll take care of that in just a second. I was noticing it, too. It's just acting up on me. Sorry about that.
It's all right. It's all right. I figured I'd mention it, though, so I don't get emails down the line.
Yeah, I'll fix it. I'm just smoking a cigarette out on the back porch, guys.
No worries. I'll tackle the next question here while you take care of that. It comes from Spencer James, and he wants to know, he says, I'd love to know if the Ruxinator thinks that the maths of the ancient societies are as useful on the subatomic scale as they are for the celestial, because I reckon if EBEs came here from somewhere else, they would have to have had at least mastered subatomic physics and maybe whatever comes after that layer of matter. Gravity, electromagnetism, magic, haha, whatever it is, still seems a long way off whichever way you cut it. So that's the question from Spencer James. I think he's trying to say if the ancient societies could do things like make the pyramids using fancy stuff and advanced science, then presumably they could extrapolate that and move it on to a much larger scale, a macro scale, if you will. I think that's kind of what he's saying.
Yes, this is actually an excellent question. What this is getting down to is what are the limits of technology and what are the limits of technology that ET has. When I was going into my theories, with Mars specifically, and with the moon as a matter of fact, the idea is that the technology that we can see the ancients showing us that they were using, if you accept that interpretation, and I do, they're using three-stage rockets, much like we did with the Apollo missions. They didn't appear to have any kind of technology that would take them further than the next planet, so to speak.
Yeah.
They may have had more advanced technology. I don't know. But they also seem to have been using three-stage rockets. They were doing landings in the ocean, the same way that we do with nose cones. We can see our Apollo program was basically based on what these guys were doing.
Hmm.
I think that's where we got the idea. So whether they were more advanced than that at that time, I don't know. Sorry about this fuzz. I'm trying to take care of it now.
It's okay. It's Ruxgiving. We have a patient audience tonight.
Yes,
don't even worry.
Fortunately.
Yeah, exactly. They're already hopped up on eggnog and God knows what, so they're all good.
There you go. I think I'm settled down now. It doesn't seem to bother me in this room. I don't know why.
So you think that the that the original space program was borrowing from the ancient aliens.
Yes.
I don't want to interrupt the point, so but I have a follow-up question to that. Go ahead.
Yes, in fact, I'm certain that that's where we got the A-bomb, too. There were notes from Robert Oppenheimer. Robert Oppenheimer, in interviews, said that we basically got it from the ancients. And you can also find notes in FDR's notebooks where he was saying the same thing. So that we resurrected an ancient technology, I think, were the words he used.
Yeah. The follow-up question, I guess, is that if the ancients were using the three-stage rockets, though, based on what we know about modern UFOs, they clearly have advanced past the three-stage rockets because they're doing things that are far beyond what it looks like a combustible engine can do, as far as we know.
And they very much appear to have had flying saucers, too, at least back in the 18th dynasty. Thutmose III recorded seeing flying shields in the sky and said he was actually taken up in one. The traditional Egyptologists would tell you that was just typical hagiography of any of the pharaohs, and there was a certain amount of that went on. But I think he was telling the truth. I think he and his court saw flying saucers, and he went up in one, and he established a mystery school afterward. He was really impressed. So, I think they had flying saucer technology as well.
Hmm.
But that wouldn't be interplanetary, or probably would not be interplanetary. Now, the real question is this. Did they, at some time, or have they developed since, a much more advanced technology, something like wormhole travel or something of that nature? I really don't know. I don't think anyone can actually answer that question. In other words, did they ever become interstellar?
Mm.
Did they actually have left the solar system and gone someplace else?
That might have been where they went.
Yes, that might be where they went. I do believe that's entirely possible. We just don't have any way of knowing. And what that question really gets down to is, what are the limits of technology? I have a personal belief, and I have no way of proving or disproving this, but I believe that there is an eventual ceiling of technology. I mean, there's a limit. We reach an end point. You found about as much technology as there is to find, and you're not going to find anything more.
Yeah.
Presumably, these guys have reached that point. Whether or not interstellar travel is possible, whether or not there are wormholes that can be navigated, any of that stuff, any of our good Star Trek questions, those are the real questions. What are the limits of technology? What limits have they reached, and what limits can we reach? How close are we? So, I think that's actually an excellent question, and I don't have a solid answer to that. That's the best answer I can give.
Yeah, it makes sense that we would... The combustible engine, the three-stage rocket, makes sense that we could kind of be able to eventually copy that. And it took us, a couple thousand years, theoretically, to pick that technology up. So we may not just be ready to master the flying saucer part of it all.
Right. I'm sure we're working on it.
Oh, yeah. That's a given. Okay. I'm thinking here, I'm just looking at the, sometimes I pause a little bit here as we move on, because I'm just double-checking on the question to make sure we covered it. But I think we did. I think, I presume that they have moved on to something else, but God knows what, and it's hard for us to really speculate on.
We can see they're more advanced than we are, we just don't know how much more advanced.
Well, I'm surprised. I know what you're talking about, because the evidence we have is these three-stage rockets, but I always imagine them more advanced back in the day.
Well, yeah, they've had 3,500 years since then. I imagine they've come up with something.
Yeah. Amalthuntha Splendora, that's the next writer. She, I'm going to presume that's a lady's name. I think I saw her picture on Facebook. Amalthuntha, I can't even do it again now. I got it right the first time. I should have quit while I was ahead.
Hold on, I got my computer up. I might be able to find it. Just a second.
It's on Facebook, so I don't know. You're not a denizen of the Book of the Faces. Amalthuntha, there we go. Splendora wants to know, have you seen the Phantasm movies? And if
yes,
so, could you comment on them, please?
Yes. Phantasm is one of those few things that I didn't get everything in Hollywood versus the Aliens, and I was aware that I would probably miss something. I missed like two or three things have come up over the years. I said, I probably should have mentioned that. I didn't mention Third Rock from the Sun at any point, and that was on TV at the time. I hadn't seen it at that point. Phantasm is one of those things that I just kind of forgot to mention.
Hmm.
Phantasm deals with, it's basically an alien abduction story or an alien invasion story, if you want to put it that way. done as a weird low-budget horror movie, which is a great deal of fun, and it gets satirized quite a bit, much to my delight, because there's a lot there to satirize. It was a very popular little cult movie, and still is, I would say. It was for decades, and they actually made sequels decades after. So it did have kind of a lasting impact. I don't think there was much that connected directly to any of the stuff that I'm writing about, other than the fact that they were actually making aliens the haunting supernatural factor in the movie.
Hmm.
But they were a lot of fun.
This is a 90s thing? I never even heard about it.
Oh, it was all the way back in the 70s.
Oh, God. Okay. Then I definitely didn't hear about it.
Yeah, this is way back. And again, I was on stage all the time. I didn't see Phantasm until probably 10 years after the thing had been out in the theaters. I caught it on a late-night TV showing one night, and I'd heard about it. When I saw it, I remember enjoying the hell out of it and thinking that it was much more complex than I expected. It's a great deal of fun to go back and watch. It's a cult movie. It's available for rent. You can get it.
Okay.
And it's definitely fun to watch. I would recommend it. It's a kick.
All right. I'll have to check it out. Kimberly says she saw it first run, so she's a hardcore Phantasma fan.
You just gave your age away, honey. That's okay. I'm up there, too.
I'm going to call out here. We haven't even – who knows when we'll get to this question. We got a question here from Jim Leidica, who just posted it on Facebook a few seconds ago. So even though the show's been underway 50 minutes, he apparently thinks he can just get the questions in at any time. I'm afraid I'm going to get them in, like, tomorrow in the afternoon. Okay, so we took care of Emil Asunta's question, and I did clear that up. That is a lady. That's what Facebook says.
Cool name, Emil Asunta.
Oh, wow, how'd you do that? You did that great. That was
I'm really good with words.
Yeah, that was amazing. Now, some of these questions read like letters from prison, and this next one definitely does. This one's from Joe V., who is actually the voice of Banal of America, one of the longtime supporters and friends of the site who does the voiceover there at the beginning of the show. That's not me. But Joe V. has three questions. Apparently because he does the voiceover, he feels like he's entitled to additional questions. And not only does he have three questions, but as I said, these read like prison letters. These seem like things that he's thought about far too long. Luckily, I sent this to you ahead of time because this is what made me email you the questions. Because I was like, you got to get a load of this, and if you need to, get a restraining order against this guy, because he's put way too much thought into this. But here's what he has to say, now that I've busted on him for a good minute and a half. He wants to know, at several points in his books, Sitchin stresses that he believes his research demonstrates that the Bible is not just a collection of fanciful stories. Although my own academic background, this is Joe V., gives me pause to accept his translations, it is notable that Sitchin's attempts to reconstruct the biblical text via Sumerian parallels, be they literary or linguistic, was a dominant school of interpretation from the 1950s until the end of the 1970s, at least. Just bear with me, folks. The Jesuit scholar Mitch Dahood was the most notable example of this. In this respect, there is nothing unusual about Sitchin's methodology and his contention that he was demonstrating the deeper historical background to biblical material. However, I am curious as to what manner, if any, this impacted his view of Judaism. To the best of your knowledge, did Sitchin's research ever impact his Judaism?
Let me hit that one first.
Okay.
Not only did it impact his research, it was his research. If Sitchin had one big overriding flaw, it was that he could not see past Zionism in his interpretations. He forced all of his interpretations to fit into an Old Testament paradigm and could not see beyond that. The only time that he really got past that was in what I consider to be his best book, The Lost Realms, where he was carrying it into the Mexican and Amerindian mythologies. That was some really good stuff. But even that, he was connecting to its Middle Eastern theories. It's still a very good book. When I was in Egypt with Sitchin, There was a time that we were alone together at breakfast, and he knew that I had read all of his books and that I was very familiar with all of his theories. And he asked me at one point which of the gods I thought was Yahweh. And to me, that was a very simple question. I said, well, that one's obvious. He said, really, who? And I said, it's Thoth. And a change took place in him, a visible change. His breathing increased. He got excited.
Hmm.
His face was flushing, and he just wanted me to keep talking. And I was describing all the parallels between Thoth and Ea and Enki. And as soon as I took it into the New Testament, as soon as I went into, in the beginning was the Word was with God, the Word was God, which is straight out of the Egyptian. The Egyptians said the same thing about Thoth. But as soon as I took it into Christianity, he got furious. He got really upset. He did not pound the table, but he was just short of that. He got really animated and excited and kind of angry. And he said, "You say that. You say that. I do not see that. You say that."
Whoa.
And I lost him completely. The conversation didn't take place too much longer. He was just very visibly upset because I had mentioned Christianity, not in the terms of a religion, but solely in the terms of its writings, exactly the same way as he was doing with Judaism and his texts. He simply could not see past Judaism, and as soon as he went past it, he couldn't handle it. He just lost it.
Yeah.
That was the greatest flaw in all of his research.
Huh. Interesting. Well, I'm speechless by both the story and the depth of this question, because I feel like I have nothing to add. Anytime someone drops a Mitch Dahood reference, I'm completely out of my depth.
Well, I think what he's getting at there, and I think this is actually the predominant view still, I do believe that there are a lot of scholars who contend that the biblical stories are not made-up stories, but that there was actual history behind them.
Hmm.
I do have a comment on that. I believe that there were some historical occurrences. Whether they happened the way that they are written of in the Bible, I don't know. This kind of gets down to finding Troy, for instance. You'll find in all the archaeological textbooks, hey, Heinrich Schliemann found Troy. He just followed all the clues in the Iliad, and here it is. Okay, Heinrich Schliemann found a city where, in theory, Troy should be. That doesn't mean that the Trojan War actually took place there. That would be like some future archaeologist discovering that there had once been a New York City, therefore there was Spider-Man. It doesn't follow.
Right.
You can set stories in understandable settings that people are going to be able to relate to. It also doesn't mean it didn't happen, or it could have happened someplace else and the story could have been grafted onto that location. We don't know. The Bible is really, really rich material. There's a lot of stuff to get into there. And how much of it is actual archaeological fact, I couldn't tell you. But I do delve into that area and at least examine it in that light. And I think it's important to examine it in that light. It also has to be borne in mind that they could simply have been moral fables that were grafted onto recognizable locations.
Yeah. Okay. Well, what I like about talking to you is that you actually knew Sitchin. There's a lot of people that talk about Sitchin, talk around Sitchin, interpret Sitchin, but you actually had breakfast with Sitchin. Was he cool with you afterwards, or was it kind of like
chill?
Yeah.
We were fine. I broadsided him with that, but what it really showed was that the man could not accept anything outside of Judaism. He just couldn't. He very much believed in everything that he wrote. He was very passionate about it, even when he was wrong. There were areas where he was demonstrably wrong, and I'm not faulting him there. The canvas that Sitchin was painting on, the amount of research that he was doing, is really huge. So it would be pretty remarkable if he got absolutely everything correct. There are some areas where he's demonstrably wrong, for instance, in planetary mechanics. I don't have a problem with the theory of the extra planet in the solar system or some very large astronomical body, whatever it may be, that periodically comes in and probably destroyed the fifth planet. I have no problem with that at all. His mechanics as to how that happened wouldn't happen that way.
Mm-hmm.
But he would insist, oh yeah, it had to be this way. It came on a direct collision course, it intersected directly, and it hit there, and that's the orbit that it has. No, it wouldn't have that orbit. It would have the orbit of the comets, and that's probably why the comets have the orbit that they have, because the comets are the other half of the shattered planet, that is, the asteroid belt. They're the debris that got taken along with it and carried around past the sun. They go all the way around the sun and then back out into what we call the Oort cloud. That's the orbit of that planet, and that's why they have that, because they're the debris of that planet.
Hmm.
That makes sense. An intercepted planet would not do an ellipse between the fourth and the fifth planet. It just wouldn't do it. It would go around the sun. But that doesn't mean that it didn't destroy the fifth planet. If it came close enough to the fifth planet on its path that it caused some kind of gravitational problem, yeah, it could have exploded or imploded that planet one way or another. And we do see the evidence of that in the asteroid belt and, as far as I'm concerned, in the comets. That's one of the reasons that I buy that theory. But Sitchin's precise interpretation of that theory is incorrect. I just don't see that it could have done an intersecting orbit like that.
Okay.
But, you know, you wouldn't be able to quibble with him on that. He'd get upset with you.
Interesting. Now, having known him, let me see. I'm going to hit a button here to turn you up for me so I can hear you better. There we go. Having known him, I don't think you'll have an answer for this in a way, because I think you said he was kind of closed off a little bit. But did he ever, obviously he believed all this stuff, and if he thinks it's true, and obviously I think it has a lot of weight to it, so I'm not downplaying it. But the point of the question is, if he believed this true, how did he feel about the fact that, yes, his stuff was wildly popular and a lot of people were interested in it, but theoretically it should be like this Copernicus discovery, and it never really got the credit it deserved if it's true. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I agree with all of those statements.
Did he ever sort of give any indication of like a frustration level with that?
He had it in perspective. I had the privilege of seeing Sitchin do translations on site. And I know one of these questions brought up, I think it just came up as a matter of fact, quibbling with Sitchin's interpretations. I can see where anyone might quibble with Sitchin's interpretations. I also have to say that I've seen him do interpretations, and I've seen him read ancient script on site with museum curators on hand to comment. And in one of those instances, we were at the Cairo Museum, and he showed us a Benben stone, a replica of a Benben stone. We don't have a real one. The Benben stone is the object that brought the gods to Earth, which looks exactly like a nose cone. It's a conical object. It's got a square or rectangular doorway in it, and you'll see a god or a goddess sitting in that doorway. That's what brought the gods to Earth. It's a nose cone. That's why I'm going with the three-stage rocket business.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he did a reading of the hieroglyphs off of Benben stone and some other object. He named specifically what the object was that he wanted to see in the Cairo Museum, and the curator took him straight to it. And, you pull the tarp off it and look at it, and there it is. It's in the storage room. And he read it on site for us. He interpreted it just on the spot. And I'm sure he had read it before and already had it in advance, but he did do his own interpretation is what I'm trying to get at.
Yeah.
And he read his interpretation, and when he was done, he looked over at the curator, who was standing right there, and he said, "Would you agree that is a correct interpretation?" And the guy said, I might question one or two words, but yeah, it's allowable. It's an allowable interpretation. So I've seen him actually do his interpretations and seen curators, endorse them.
Yeah.
The man was a linguist, and he was a very, very good one. I do quibble with some of his facts and some of his details. His basic arguments I don't have a problem with. It's his details where he gets kind of messed up, and especially when he gets into the Zionism. He would frequently throw interpretations of which god was which that were way off base, and anyone could see that if they weren't trying to force it into a Zionist perspective, except him, because that's what he did. So this is all kind of a long roundabout way of saying that he did recognize that his ideas were unorthodox and that they were not going to be accepted, and he knew that. He told me privately, and he probably told some other people too, that there were a number of museum curators who he would not name, but I believe him completely, who privately acknowledged to him that they knew what he was writing about was true, but that they could not openly say so because they would have to rewrite all of the textbooks, they'd have to get everybody their degrees all over again. It would just upset the economy, and it would upset the status quo too much.
Yeah.
I believe that completely. I'm quite sure he was telling me the truth as far as that was concerned. So he had that in perspective, and he did not believe that he was ever going to change the world's mind on anything. So I don't think he was upset about that or even frustrated. I think he was actually more pleased to find that there were any people who listened to him and understood what he was saying.
I see. Yeah, exactly. It's just that anyone was giving him a chance, probably.
You
got to stick with that. You got to hang on to that, because that's all you got, because the mainstream isn't giving you a chance anyway.
Yeah.
All right. We'll move in. As I said, Joe V submitted three questions, but since he's the voiceover guy, we'll allow it. And I should mention, the people in the chat are firing questions at me, but they didn't follow the rules. They were supposed to submit them a long time ago, so they have to go to the very end of the line.
that's fine. If we've got time, we'll throw them in.
Exactly. Question two from Joe V. More on Sitchin. He says, given what you know of Sitchin's work and given your own conclusions, Do you have any particular opinion on certain well-known authors who frequently make cameos on a certain documentary series? He's talking about Ancient Aliens here.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, there's no need to dance around it.
I'm already grinning.
Okay. Alleging that they've found mystical stargates, hidden Gnostic codes leading to hyper-spiritual states and other such things by, quote-unquote, decoding Sitchin's books. I should mention also, just to keep on the pylon on Jovi, he keeps spelling Sitchin's name wrong. He's spelling it Sitchin. Which is his not.
Yeah.
he's going to love listening to this tomorrow. He wants to know, do they miss the point, these people who are finding things, quote-unquote, or would Sitchin himself have argued in favor of their conclusions? And then, thankfully, he says, I guess what I'm trying to say is, Will Henry, a load of happy horseshit, or is there something remotely credible about him?
I'm not sure which one Will Henry is.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know either. To be honest, so.
The one I usually laugh at is the Greek guy.
Oh, with the hair, yeah.
He's way the hell out there. I don't know what he's on. That's a kind of an interesting grab bag of a show. I've caught a few episodes just in rerun. And sometimes they hit on some interesting stuff, and other times they're just dicking around.
Hmm.
Half the time when they're dicking around, you can tell that they're not really talking, like, was Bigfoot an alien? So, okay, look, you guys want to be serious or do you just want to fuck around here? And they just want to screw around.
Yeah. Well, they have to, I'm sure they have a certain order of episodes to fill. And so they're up
right.
to like episode 8 of season 3. And they're like, how about is Loch Ness Monster an ancient robot that was left behind by aliens?
Yeah, exactly. Like, you want to be serious about this or do you want to just mess around? So I understand they got to fill time and fill a schedule and all that other kind of nonsense and what have you. And it's kind of fun if you don't have anything else to do at the time.
Hmm.
You can sit back and enjoy it and just kind of have a good laugh. And God knows if you're doing this kind of research, and especially if you're doing it seriously, it is fun to sit back and kind of poke fun at it now and then. It just kind of lets the steam off. Anyway, Will Henry, I couldn't say specifically because I'm not sure which one he is.
Right. I'm honestly in the dark on that, but I want
right.
to yeah, let him get his say in. But, yeah, the point I guess he's trying to make, and I'll sort of tighten this up because apparently he just wanted me to read a long thing. But I think what he's saying is there are quote-unquote experts out there who are reading the Sitchin books and finding additional stuff that either Sitchin himself didn't realize was in there or covered – I don't want to say covered up because if anyone was not doing any covering up, I doubt it was Sitchin because he was putting out this really fringe stuff. But maybe Sitchin himself discounted it and didn't think that. And what he's saying is, do you think there is additional stuff in there that maybe Sitchin didn't realize or didn't want to talk about or any other sort of reason?
There are two parts to that question, and I'll answer both of them. Could there be things in Sitchin that Sitchin missed? Yes, and I do believe there are things in Sitchin that he missed, largely because of his forced Zionist interpretations. There could also be any number of technological questions that he either did not perceive because they were not in his background, or he just wasn't looking in that direction. So, yeah, I consider that to be entirely possible. As to whether or not any of these people coming up with the various codes or what have you have actually come up with anything, my guess, not knowing which ones specifically are being discussed, is probably it's just a load. They're just coming up with a lot of crap. There are even researchers in the field whom I respect, Richard Hoagland being one of them, who kind of go a little nutty. They just kind of go off base a little now and then. Where Hoagland has done a lot of very good research, I think, he also comes up with these wild interpretations of how many different dimensions there are and different energy pathways and blah, 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 and states them as if they are fact, as if they're established in some way, based on the Sidonia mathematics, as he likes to put it, or the message of Sidonia or something like that. Say, okay, I believe he's sincere. I also think he's wrong. I don't think that any of that is there or that it can even be implied. However, if he wants to toss it out there, and maybe there are some physicists who feel otherwise, who knows? Maybe he's actually coming up with something, and I'm just too thick to see it, which is a fancy way of saying, you know, it's okay to theorize, but don't be stupid with it.
Okay. Yeah. I don't have much to add, because I'm only vaguely familiar with the Sitchin stuff, so I think you could... It's almost like The Shining, in a way, you know? There are people that could probably pick up the Sitchin books... And then they read into it, and they're saying, you know, there's a Stargate in here. Don't you see it? How could Sitchin not see there's a Stargate in here? And it's like, no, it's just
And conversely, there are people that would read such and immediately toss them out with the bathwater and say, this is the worst Drek I've ever read.
Well, to be honest, since this is the equivalent of us sitting around the bar, that's pretty close to where I was on Sitchin stuff. I read about the first 30 to 60 pages of the first book, and then I put it down, and I just said, I can't get through this stuff, so I never really gave it a fair chance. But I've heard plenty of summations of it, so I'm well-versed in that.
Yeah, I understand. You're hardly alone. In fact, you're the majority.
It's a tough book to get through. I my hat's off to the people who have read all of them. I know you have, but there's a small group of people that are well versed and can tell you what, you know, the seventh or eighth book was in that whole series. But to me, it's like, wow. It's hard.
Sitchin is almost a labor of love for me, and has to be, because as a person, Sitchin was about the worst asshole I ever met in my entire life. He was just an asshole to asshole all the way down the line.
You speak so fondly of him, though.
Well, it's because the man was brilliant. I kind of excuse his eccentricities because the man was brilliant. He opened a lot of people's eyes to a lot of things, mine especially. But just as a person, he was a dick.
I think, yeah. Didn't you tell me a story? I think you told it on the show once. I think he wrote you a letter or something, and he gave you a backhanded compliment.
Every letter. Every letter, every conversation. We never had any exchange of words in which he would not say something that was kind of a backhanded compliment and end up insulting me. His last paragraph or his last sentence would invariably be an insult. The guy was the most passive-aggressive asshole I ever met.
Oh, my God.
It wasn't just me. He did that with everybody. He did that if he liked you.
Now we've really got a holiday special on our hands here. This is this is what it's like sitting at the bar. In a way, it kind of comes back to what I was talking about with you earlier, where it's like getting his mind. He's a genius. He may have come up with this Copernicus-esque discovery, and he has to do the UFO conference circuit. And when he's like, "Where's my Nobel Prize? I hate all of you."
There is also another factor to Sitchin,
mm-hmm.
and that is that he was not entirely honest. It had no place in any of Sitchin's books, and I didn't find this out until many years after I had read them. I took for granted that he gave credit to Alexander Kazantsev. I don't remember him ever bringing up Alexander Kazantsev's name once. He doesn't cite Kazantsev's famous Pravda piece, The Tenth Planet. He doesn't mention Kazantsev at all. Everything that Sitchin wrote was a popularization of Alexander Kazantsev in Russia, who wrote a piece in 1960 called The Tenth Planet that was serialized in Pravda. Alexander Kazantsev was the godfather of ancient astronaut theory. He studied all of this stuff. Now, mind you, Sitchin took Kazantsev's research and took it further, so I'll give him credit for that. But he was also politicizing it, which, again, is my problem. He had to Zionize everything. If he couldn't Zionize it, it didn't exist.
Yeah.
That was his one real great flaw. Aside from, well, that and his insistence on certain disprovable things. As far as the level of his research, though, I do have to compliment him. He did take the Kazantsev research further than it had gone before, I believe, and especially took it into the Sumerology very, very heavily, and I think extremely well.
All right.
What's your Thanksgiving song?
No.
Pass.
No.
The cranberry sauce we're having mashed potatoes. Ooh, the turkey looks great.
Len.
Thank you for loving me.
Len.
Thank you for being there.
Oh, God.
Everyone's thanking.
Len.
The whole world's thanking you.
Stop.
Thanking
Len.
Us for thanking
Stop.
You.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Pass. Oh. The cranberry sauce we're having mashed potatoes. Oh, the turkey looks great. Thank you for loving me.
Len.
Thank you for being there.
Please.
Thank you for loving me. Everyone's thanking. The whole
Len.
World's thanking you. Thanking
Stop.
Us for thanking you.